This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
It's a question everyone has been asking since the moment Brian Koberger stood up in that Boise courtroom and pled guilty to four counts of taking the lives of those four students. Why now? After nearly 2 years of pretrial motions, gag orders, DNA fights, discovery delays, and endless speculation about whether he'd ever face a jury, why pull the plug days before opening statements? That answer might not just be in the courtroom. It might be in the family area. Because just a few days before that plea deal was struck, prosecutors released their witness list. And one name stood out like a flare in the dark. His sister. The same sister whose phone he allegedly stole back in 2014. An act his own father reported to police. The same sister who, by all accounts, had tried to live a quiet, normal life while the rest of the world dissected her brother's every move. And I'm not even going to say her name on the show because she deserves privacy. She's not part of her brother's insane mind and motive or whatever the hell was going on. Of course, people can find her, but there's a speed bump. And what's the point? Now, she was on the prosecution's list. And that might have been the one thing Brian couldn't stomach. If you think about Brian Koberger as a control-driven personality, which nearly every behavioral expert who's looked at him agrees with, this makes sense. Control was his currency. From the way he approached women, to his academic obsessions, to his fixation on criminal behavior and forensic countermeasures, everything about him screamed control. And we also know he has a little history with control issues, especially around his family. You know, stealing your sister's phone, selling it off, getting literally charged for that, being turned into the police by your own family. Then we have the stories of the holidays where the sisters allegedly were the ones who were kind of going to the family going, "Mom, Dad, it might be him. It might be your little angel that you can't admit has a ton of problems that no one can fix, including you." I'm paraphrasing, but I'm going to guess that might be how it went. When he lost control academically, socially, psychologically, he spiraled. When his teaching assistant position at Washington State University was revoked after repeated complaints about his aggressive tone and inappropriate conduct, he unraveled even further. And if there's one thing that could have shattered that illusion of superiority for good, it would have been being forced to face his family, especially his sister he wronged in open court. Because a trial wasn't just about proving guilt, it was about exposure. Every personal failure, every lie, every humiliation, every past wound, all of it was about to be laid bare. And he thought he was like going to get away from all of that happening. He didn't think like, oh, by the way, there's a whole world of podcasts out there and investigators and people who really want to expose what a slimy piece of crap you are to the world every which way we possibly can. That we're just going to shut up. You got more exposure this way than probably actually going through trial, you dipshit. Thinking hasn't been one of your strong suits, now has it? And if you believe in the idea that Koberger's crimes were in part fueled by narcissistic rage, a pathological need to assert dominance after years of feeling inferior, then facing the mirror of shame could have been the final breaking point. Let's look at the timeline. June 25th of 2025, the prosecution files its witness list. More than 180 potential witnesses, victim siblings, surviving roommates, forensic techs, but only one immediate Koberger family member, his sister. Within days, Brian accepts a plea deal, pleading guilty to avoid the death penalty. He's sentenced to four consecutive life sentences without parole. No trial, no testimony, no cross-examination, just silence. Is this the only possible reason why he did it? No. Could it be one of them? Sure. Coincidence? Possibly. But legally and psychologically, it is a powerful trigger point. From a legal strategy standpoint, the defense was running out of road. And they had been for quite some time. Ann Taylor had fought hard to suppress certain evidence, to split the trial phases, to limit the visibility of the state's case, but the judge's rulings were mostly going against them. The DNA evidence, though partially contested, had been deemed admissible. Cell phone data, surveillance footage, behavioral tracking, all cleared for use. The surviving roommates were prepared to testify. And the Chapin siblings, who found the crime scene, were also slated to take the stand. In other words, Taylor was looking at a bloodbath. A plea deal, especially one that avoided the death penalty, wasn't a loss. It was survival. But whether that decision came from Taylor or from Brian himself is another question. Because from everything we've seen in this case, Koberger wasn't exactly cooperative. He fired off grievances against the jail, argued with the defense team, even attempted to file his own pro se motions early on, motions that were rambling, defiant, and self-righteous. He saw himself as smarter than the system, smarter than his professors, smarter than law enforcement. So what changed? Well, here's one theory. He finally realized he wasn't just on trial for murder. He was on trial for the illusion of who he thought he was. A jury trial would have demolished that. Prosecutors were ready to present him not as a criminal mastermind, but as a failed academic, a socially awkward outcast, a man who fantasized about dominance but couldn't sustain it in real life. A man who would have been reprimanded by his own department. A man who'd been accused of stalking women. A man whose father once called the police on him. And then there was his sister, the one family member who could publicly confirm a story that undermined his entire self-mythology. Because if he'd been willing to steal from her at 19, humiliate his family, involve his father in a petty crime, what else was he capable of doing for a sense of control? That's the irony here. In trying to protect his ego, Koberger may have ended up protecting his family. A trial would have dragged them through the mud. His mother, Mary Ann, his father, Michael, both sisters. They would have had to relive old memories, answer uncomfortable questions, face families of victims, and sit under the glare of the nation's cameras. His sister's name on that list wasn't just procedural, it was personal. She wasn't a victim of the murders, but she was a victim of Brian and his behavior and having to grow up next to that and call it a brother. Well, mom and dad shield his behavior until they can no more. Testifying would have forced her to publicly confront that dynamic. Was it the shame that made him fold, or guilt, or maybe, just maybe, the final act of control disguised as mercy? Or maybe that's us reading too much into it, that he thought that far ahead, that he thought, well, this will look like mercy. Does it, or is it just he didn't want to feel icky inside because little Brian's not good at feeling icky feelings? Makes him mad. We don't want to make him mad. By pleading guilty, Brian Koberger ensured that his family wouldn't have to testify. He took the narrative back, at least in his mind. Now we get to talk about all of this way. Let's talk about that psychology for a second. If you strip away the legal framework and look purely at behavior, Koberger fits the mold of a narcissistic offender with antisocial features. Not necessarily a full-blown psychopath, although some could argue that. Though that's very arguable. but certainly someone driven by ego, humiliation, and power imbalance. He sought to control others to fill an internal void. He projected competence while living in failure. He viewed people, especially women, as vessels for his own validation. For someone like that, having his sister testify would have been unbearable. The rest of us thinking, well, sister, she's going to talk about you stealing her phone. What's the deal? The pain scale of narcissists when it comes to things like this, when it comes to being exposed, unbearable. To you and me, being caught in a white lie or something fairly minor, uncomfortable, sure, but not unbearable. We're talking like scalding hot irons all over your body, but in your brain. That's why they avoid accountability. That's why they make up such absurd lies and drag everyone else through the mud. Because that pain, the idea of having to face reality of who they actually are, so unbearable. I know it sounds crazy, but when you understand how these brains work, it explains it. It does not excuse it in any way, shape, or form. But if you're trying to understand, that should help you. Because this wouldn't just expose his past misdeeds. It would undermine his identity. And that identity that's so fragile, so carefully crafted, that if someone even walks into that identity and taps it. Oh! I'm sorry, folks. That's a massive earthquake to that fragile brain. Being unmasked by someone who knew him before he became Brian the criminology expert, or Brian the infamous killer, would be psychological death far worse than prison in his mind. When you study narcissistic collapse, this is what it looks like. The mask falls, the ego crumbles, and then the power dynamic, it flips. And the narcissist's only remaining weapon? Withdrawal. That's why so many of them just run away when forced to deal with looking in the mirror at the reality of the chaos they caused by their own decisions. Turn and run. So he withdrew from trial, from testimony, from confrontation. He chose the quiet of life sentences over the spectacle of humiliation. Little did he know that all of us existed out here. Although he probably did, but his ego said, they're not going to care anymore. Oh, trust me, we're going to care until a broomstick is protruding from your orifices and there's a date of death announced by the prison system. It's also worth noting what happened after sentencing. As court cameras captured the final moments, Brian walked out of the courtroom without even glancing at his mother or sister, who actually came to support him. And that's an assumption. I should say that. That's an assumption. They might have been there for their own mental health. To do what was right for them, by them, for their own psychology. Their own mindset of trying to understand what is ununderstandable. I don't know if that's even a word. He gave them no goodbye, no acknowledgement, just a vacant stare and a quick exit. Probably like most days when they were with Brian. There's his vacant stare again, our soulless son. Rosemary's baby. That in itself tells a story. It wasn't compassion. It wasn't reconciliation. It was severance. The final act of control, removing himself from the emotional equation. There's another layer here that's harder to quantify, but equally haunting. The idea that he wanted to spare his sister the guilt of condemning him. She had taken the stand and testified to that phone theft or anything about the past behavior it would have been devastating for her. And for someone as image-obsessed as Koberger, the optics of his own family helping to convict him would have been intolerable. So make no mistake, it wasn't to have any consideration for the exposure that she would be putting herself in front of. It was protecting him still. Pleading guilty neutralized that risk. He could still tell himself somewhere deep down that he decided the outcome, not his sister, not the jury, not the state. It's twisted logic, but that's how narcissistic reasoning works. Losing control publicly is worse than dying privately. There's one more question we have to ask. Did the family have anything to do with his plea? We may never know for sure. They've not said anything publicly. But given that his defense team included family members on both their mitigation and witness lists, it's fair to assume there might have been discussions or pressure. Maybe one of them even confronted him about the emotional toll. It's all speculation. Maybe someone said it's unwinnable and the humane choice was just to end it. Or maybe he simply read the room and saw the inevitable. By June of 25, it wasn't just the evidence that was damning, it was the narrative. Every headline, every motion, every leak had painted him into a corner. The illusion of innocence was gone. When a narcissist can no longer control perception, they look for the next best thing. Timing. Control the timing. When the story ends, how it ends, who gets to speak, all of that. So maybe this plea wasn't surrender, it was choreography. In the end, Brian Koberger avoided the death penalty, but he didn't escape the one thing he feared the most. Exposure. Because even without a trial, the truth came out in pieces, and still is. His failures, his contradictions, his desperate need to appear intelligent while behaving recklessly, it's all public record now. And perhaps that's fitting. Because for someone who once studied the criminal mind so intensely, Koberger never understood that one principle that governs them all. You can't outsmart reality forever. Give me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube if that's where you are. If not, search us. Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. If you're listening to us on the podcast platform, you can also search us there if you're on YouTube and take us with you wherever you go. Let us know those thoughts. I do appreciate that, and please do press subscribe. Until next time, I am Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now, and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.